If you like Area 45, you're going to enjoy the Hoover Institution's other podcasts, Uncommon Knowledge, The Classicist with Victor Davis Hanson, and The Libertarian with Richard Epstein. Subscribe now to the Hoover Podcast at hoover.org/podcasts. That's hoover.org/podcasts. Hoover Podcast, ideas defining a free society. Hello, it's Thursday, May the 10th, and welcome to Area 45, a Hoover Institution podcast examining the policy avenues available to the 45th President of the United States. I'm Bill Whalen, a Hoover Research Fellow. Joining me today in studio here on the campus of Stanford University, Dr. Abbas Milani. He's a Hoover Research Fellow, the Hamid and Christina Mogadam Director of Iranian Studies at Stanford University, and a professor by courtesy in the Division of Stanford Global Studies. He's written numerous books on Iran, Persia, and his earlier days as a native of that land. Abbas, we were sitting in this same studio in this very same location 4 months and one day ago talking about the options available to Donald Trump vis-a-vis Iran. And yesterday he gave us an indication as to what he wants to do with Iran. He withdrew the U.S. from the JCPOA Iran nuclear agreement. Were you surprised by that?
I wasn't surprised, but I was dismayed nevertheless.
Dismayed.
I thought of all the options in trying to fix what was clearly a flawed deal, This is probably the least likely to succeed, because I think it's going to leave the United States on an almost collision course with European allies, certainly with Russia and China. And it's going to give an out to the Iranian regime to blame the U.S. for the utter failure of the Iranian economy that has been the result of its own mismanagement, corruption, cronyism.
Okay. I'm going to read you two comments made about Trump's decision, and I want your opinion of these. Bear with me, they're both rather long-winded, so sit back, take a drink of water, take a deep breath. The first comes from a reporter named Gerald Seib, who writes for the Wall Street Journal. Actually, I know Jerry Seib. Interesting sidebar about Jerry Seib. He was in Iran in 1987, and he was detained by the government. He was trying to leave the country, and they pulled him out of customs, and they declared him a spy of the Zionist regime, and there he sat in Iranian jail for a while. But here's what Jerry wrote about Trump's decision. Quote, "The core of the president's gamble is that a renewal of full-bore economic sanctions on Iran will be enough to compel its leaders back to the table to renegotiate the nuclear deal completed during President Barack Obama's term. In fact, Mr. Trump flatly predicted Iran leaders will do exactly that. Alternatively, his calculation appears to be that of a resumption of full-bore American pressure will so disrupt a weak Iranian economy, already reeling from rising prices, a falling currency, and a long drought, that the result will be growing dissatisfaction and internal unrest that threatens the very survival of the regime." So there's one school of thought. Starvation diet forces the change that you want. Here is the other argument, and this comes from the website Vox. And I'll read it to you now. Quote, "Americans often like to pretend that Iran doesn't have a political system and is instead an undifferentiated mass of anti-American religious zealots bent on building a bomb to challenge America. This was never accurate, and the nuclear deal proved it. The deal was the pet project of a relatively moderate faction of the Iranian political elite, led by President Rouhani and Foreign Minister Javad Zarif. That faction argued that giving up Iran's nuclear program would lead to an increased economic ties with the rest of the world, and thus prove that cooperation with the world and integration into the international community was a better foreign policy than conflict. Confrontation. So long as a deal was in place, they had a point. But Trump's decision to withdraw from the agreement has given their more hardline opponents, including the leaders of Iran's elite Revolutionary Guard, the upper hand of the domestic political argument." So there's your other school of thought. If one is that starvation is what forces the Iranians in the right direction, the other is that, no, we've made a terrible mistake. We've now actually encouraged them to go back to their wayward ways. So what say you, Abbas?
I say I agree with elements of both of these.
Elements of both.
My sense is that if there is a hidden logic behind the Trump administration's decision, it is the logic of regime change, close to the first comment. I think they are looking at the same numbers that I am looking at, and they probably have access to numbers that I don't have access to. And those numbers indicate that indeed the Iranian economy is reeling. The Iranian currency in the last 3 months has lost almost 70% of its value. 3 months ago, if you had a dollar, you would get 3,000 tuman. Today, if you have a dollar, we could possibly get 8,000 tuman, from 3 to 8. And nobody is selling. Even if you're willing to pay 8,000, you can't find it in the market because everybody who has dollars or euros or gold is sitting on it because they think it's going to increase in value, and the price of Iranian currency is going to devalue. So I think the logic of it is that if more pressure is brought, and this very fraught economy is put under even more pressure, then the people will rise, the regime will collapse, and something else better will emerge. I think part of that logic is absolutely correct. I think the Iranian economy is very fraught. I think it is primarily the result of mismanagement and corruption and cronyism, as I said. But I'm not sure the unilateral U.S. sanctions is going to push them beyond the brink that they are already. Mm-hmm. In terms of the second quote, I disagree that the reason the Iranians came to the negotiating table was because it was the pet project of moderates.
Right.
The Iranians came to the negotiating table, and most important of all, Khamenei, the hardliner supreme leader, known for his intransigent anti-Americanism, he came to the negotiating table, first of all, before Rouhani even came to presidency, mm-hmm. the fact that is well now known. They began their negotiations in Oman before Rouhani was the president. And once Rouhani was the president, the process was expedited. So it is correct that the moderates have been trying to make this negotiation, but what made the regime come to the table were those biting sanctions that the Obama administration, with the help of UN, and remarkably with the help of China and Russia, brought to the table. The Iranian economy there was also on the verge of collapse.
Right.
The currency collapsed from 1,000 to 3,000, going up to 4,000, nearing 5,000. And they panicked. They literally panicked. And I think they decided they need to make some serious concessions. Clearly, who might win out of all of this domestically in the short term, I think,
right.
again, are the radicals. Khamenei has already begun to say, I told you so, the Americans can't be trusted. Mm-hmm. Yesterday, some of his stupid fans and followers in the parliament burned an American flag, or better yet, in their utter incompetence, they tried to burn it and couldn't get it because their lighter wouldn't work. I mean, it's just the video of it has gone viral.
Right.
It shows the idiocy and the incompetence. But I think that's a short-term solution. The hardliners don't have an answer to Iran's major, major economic challenges. Mm-hmm. And that's why if I was advising President Trump, I would have said, leave the deal alone, make for much more vigorous inspection, work with the Europeans to bring in the other elements that you are rightly worried about, and in the process, allow this course of events to take its, I think, inevitable path, which would be a fundamentally re-altered status quo.
Mm-hmm. From the perspective of the Iranian people, the Iranian populace, Abbas, developing nuclear technology, nuclear power, and perhaps developing nuclear weaponry, countries do this for different reasons. Some do it as part of their military flexing. Some do it for extortion or leverage, if you will. North Korea is a good example of this. Others do it for just simply prestige. What do you think motivates Iran to go down the road to have a bomb?
My sense is that they wanted to have, first of all, they wanted to have a breakout capacity. Mm-hmm. That is, I think after 2003, when the U.S. defeated Iraqi army
right.
in very short order, the same army that Iran fought for 8 years, a million people, billions of loss to a standstill, they were very scared of what the U.S. might do. The U.S. had about 150,000, 200,000 forces in the vicinity, and word was that next stop might be Tehran. Mm-hmm. So they, by the best intelligence available to the U.S., in 2003, they gave up the weaponizing part of their nuclear program. But they put everything else intact. They kept everything else intact because they want to have a breakout capacity. Mm-hmm. They want to put everything in place.
Right.
They want to know the technology, and they want to have the delivery system. Mm-hmm. And I think they want to have it because they think it is part of their bet against being pushed around by the United States or being pushed around by Israel, which is a very dominant nuclear power in the region.
So you're suggesting this is, in effect, leverage, that's their way of saying to the world, if you want to come into our country, oh, by the way, we have the technology and the weapon that we can easily fire at Tel Aviv.
Absolutely. That we could use a weapon, a bomb. And in that sense, if you go back, the Iranian nuclear program was begun by the Shah. Mm-hmm. And under the Shah, it virtually had the same kind of a dual purpose, going for a breakout capacity strategy behind it. And interestingly, even then the United States, although the Shah was a very close ally of the United States, mm-hmm. the United States brought pressure on the Shah to try to dissuade him from going down that path.
Right. Let's go through some winners and losers in this deal, Abbas, beginning with the idea of propagandists, the people you mentioned who were burning the American flag. I think they're trying to burn an American piece of paper, I think, as well.
Yeah.
Who came up with the phrase death to America? This is kind of a rather unique Iranian way of saying things. Is I don't think I've heard another country say death to America the way the Iranians do.
They certainly, I don't know of other countries who have said it as persistently and as for as long as the Iranian regime has been saying
that,
it. But
that phrase has been around, I think, since the fall of the Shah.
Certainly since the fall of the Shah. But even before the fall of the Shah, in the 50s, ironically, mm-hmm. when Iran had a very powerful Soviet-funded Communist Party, one of the first anti-American rhetoric and death to America and calling the American embassy a den of spies.
Den of spies.
Was coined by the communists at that time.
Right. Gets back to the Jerry spy of the Zionist regime talk.
Exactly, at that time. But I think after, although the Carter administration mm-hmm. was very, very critical in the ability of Khomeini to seize power.
Right.
At one time, the Carter administration decided that the Shah must go. They look for the alternatives, and they thought that Khomeini would be the best alternative. A very strange decision at the time. But in spite of that, as soon as Khomeini came to power, he began his anti-American crusade. Mm-hmm. And then when Khomeini, the now supreme leader, who has been the supreme leader for almost 30 years, when he came to power, as a supreme leader, he brought his own remarkable anti-Americanism mm-hmm. to the stage. I've read some of the books he wrote before the revolution. They are infused with a kind of anti-American rhetoric that he has borrowed from the Egyptian Sayyid Qutb, the founder of Muslim Brotherhood's ideology. Some people have called him the grandfather of Islamic radicalism. Mm-hmm. Khomeini translated four of his books, and in those you could see the seeds of a theoretical, almost emotional aversion to the United States. And he has doubled down on this, in my view, stupid anti-American rhetoric mm-hmm. and keeps trying to promote it.
Right.
There were people in the regime, and here it goes back to the second quote that you mentioned. There are moderates in the regime who have for almost 30 years said, this is a stupid slogan. It ain't going to get us anywhere. We got to get off this page and have a rapprochement with the United States.
You just lead me into my second question, which is moderates. What do moderates within Iran do now?
Well, I think we're talking about...
And actually, I'm sorry, but let's actually add to that. Are there moderates in Iran? Because there are people who support Trump's action thinking that, no, there really is no moderate movement in Iran. It's just as a nation of hardliners, can't be trusted. But you would contend there are moderates.
Oh, absolutely. I would contend that there are two categories of moderates.
Okay, so where are they right now? What do they do?
The biggest category of moderates are the Iranian people, mm-hmm. who I think great numbers, by maybe 70%, despise this regime, want to change, realize that it has brought nothing but misery to them.
No way we could do a poll and find out.
Well, there are some polls.
Have they really?
Yeah, in the sense, when they have asked people how satisfied you are where people have voted in elections, controlled elections,
right,
and they have seen one candidate as being critical of the status quo. Mm-hmm. So we can make conjectures that are almost accurate. And also people are voting with their feet. The best and the brightest are leaving the country, number one country in the brain drain. So the Iranian people want to change this regime, but they don't want to have another Syria. They know this regime is partly responsible for the calamity that is Syria. And they know they would do to Iran what this regime has done to Syria. So they are the real moderates of Iran, the people who want change but want to avoid violent revolutionary change. But within the regime, there are elements like Rouhani and before him like Rafsanjani who want to preserve this regime. And thus, if you think this regime is incorrigible, then there are no moderates if they want to preserve this regime. But they want to preserve a slightly different regime. They see the writing on the wall. They see the status quo is untenable.
Let's talk a bit about how information flows here. So I assume that the state controls media. So the population gets fed propaganda. They see the photo op you mentioned in Parliament. They read editorials, if you will. They hear what the leaders say. Do they have a means to find out what the rest of the world thinks about their country and what the rest of the world would like to proceed? How do they get information beyond their borders?
Well, actually, we have some good data on how much people listen to the Iranian media, and it's less than 10%.
Less than 10%.
Less than 10%.
They just know it's an in-house organ of the party.
They think it's all propaganda, it's all nonsense, it's all recitation of Quran.
Okay.
Very little of entertainment value. BBC Persian, there is a program called Manoto, which essentially does old films and Turkish serials. Jam TV, these have millions of watchers.
Right.
Iran also is one of the most internet-connected countries in the Middle East. There are 40 million Telegram users in Iran.
Telegram users?
Telegram users. There are 110 million SIM cards for smartphones.
Right.
So there are at least 60 million smartphones. Everybody seems to have a smartphone. And they have access to Facebook, which is illegal, Twitter, which is filtered and illegal, Telegram, which was just filtered, and people have found ways around it. And there is a battle within the government, again, to go back to our previous question. Khamenei wants to shut down Telegram.
Right.
Rouhani says, we can't do this. People do business on this. And you can't close people's minds by... You know, this is not 19th century. This is not the Stalinist Russia where you can make a shortwave radio illegal. People are going to find a way to get access. So Iran is very paradoxical. It is one of the most oppressive, controlled media, but also people have access to all of these different forms of information, and there are some media outlets within the country who are increasingly critical. They can't criticize Khamenei, they can't criticize Islam, but they can criticize on the margins.
That's interesting because if we look at, say, China, Abbas, what are the Chinese, what is the Chinese government trying to do at all times? It is fighting satellite dishes on roofs, and it's fighting social media like Facebook. It's trying its best to keep people confined within their border.
That's exactly the model in Iran. On satellite dishes, they failed. They made it illegal. They made it a crime. They sent their paratroopers and stormtroopers literally from helicopters to shut down these satellite dishes. People kept reinstalling them. So now they have given up on that. Now the new front is social media, and they're very much trying to follow the Chinese model by creating a sort of a national internet and shut down access. But it hasn't yet worked.
Right. So there's an entire page on the Stanford website which is dedicated to you and your writing. Are you telling me that a middle-class person in Iran, I don't know what sort of computer they would use. I don't know if they sell Apple or any U.S. any products in Iran. But are you telling me that somebody living in Iran in a middle-class existence can open up their laptop and they can connect with your Stanford site?
Oh, absolutely.
They can.
Their site is filtered. My site is filtered.
Right.
But they have ways of... bypassing.
Could they Google you and find you on Google and track down your writings that way? Or is the government constantly trying to figure out ways they could get to Abbas Milani and block it?
The government constantly tries to do that, but people constantly outsmart the government. Right. And some of the cleverness that these people have, I talked to some of the dissidents inside Iran. They know at all times what is the best application that cannot be controlled and censored or intercepted by the government. It used to be that Facebook was, for example, good. Then they said, no, the regime has learned how to now monitor Facebook.
Right.
The best way to do it is Telegram, or the best way to do it is WhatsApp. And I told one of them that, it's very uncomfortable for me to just do WhatsApp because we're writing on my phone. It says, well, do it on your iPad. Mm-hmm. I asked Stanford IT, I said, can I download iPad on my WhatsApp on my iPad? They said, no, there's no way.
Right.
They knew how to do it inside Iran. It was just remarkable for me, which is a paradox. You have this oppressive, brutal regime that tries to shut down everything, but then you have people who are savvy and are constantly bypassing. Mm-hmm. And because they have these phones now, every time there is an instance of police brutality, for example, the video of it goes viral.
Interesting. What is your relationship, Abbas, with the Iranian regime? Are you considered an enemy of the state? Are you on a watch list? Are you someone they just monitor? Do they, through third parties, send you little "we're watching you" notes? Do you get spammed by Iranian bots when you write things critical? How does your relationship work?
Well, almost all of the above. I am officially considered by the regime to be an agent of the United States government, and occasionally the agent of Israeli Zionist entity, as they call it.
Mm-hmm.
They have literally considered, they have written this in an indictment, that I and Larry Diamond, my friend and colleague, and Mike McFaul, my friend and colleague, two other Hoover fellows at Stanford faculty, we were the masterminds of the Green Revolution, the 2009 revolution, that we have been working to undermine the regime.
That's funny. That's not on your Stanford biography.
Yes, it isn't. And it's also said that I was the conduit of all the CIA money to the opposition in Iran, which was just wonderfully hilarious.
Right.
we get efforts to hack our site almost on a weekly basis. But, we are not sitting ducks. We and Stanford and Hoover, they have a very good system of protecting their websites and our web.
We've had fellows hacked before, attempts to hack them. So
yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So does that make you the great Satan or Satan or Satan's underling? What status would you be?
Satan's underling.
Satan's
underling. I'm one of the Satan's underlings.
Okay. So, Abbas, when Trump announced his decision, well, what's interesting about this whole situation is, first of all, to those listening, you see the letters JCPOA attached to the nuclear deal. That stands for Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. And that's a long way of saying this is not a treaty.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not a treaty because when Barack Obama went down this path, what? He looked at the United States Senate, which has to have 67 votes to enact a treaty, and it would never receive 67 votes in that Senate. All Republicans would vote against, and a handful of Democrats, I imagine, would. So it's not a treaty, so it gets called a deal, and that's not sloppy language. It's the what you have to call a non-treaty. Trump, in announcing his decision, though, Abbas, he laid down a series of conditions for going back to the table with Iran. And I want to go through these one by one, and I want you to just sort of rate the likeliness of each one from zero being when pigs fly to 10 being this is actually easier than you think. So let's do them one by one. You ready?
Can I make one brief comment?
Yes.
You're absolutely right about the ambiguity of the status of this agreement, whether it was a treaty or – but within the treaty, it is very clearly indicated how any party – can withdraw from it.
Right.
Trump didn't follow the letter of that agreement. In other words, the agreement says, if you're dissatisfied, if you think one side is cheating, you file a complaint, the complaint is adjudicated, and if you're still unsatisfied, you can withdraw.
Mm-hmm.
That process wasn't followed. But I think in terms of the legal question, I'm not qualified to answer.
Okay, Trump conditions. You ready?
Yes.
Here goes. Condition number one. These are all pertaining to Iran. Condition number one, Iran can never have an ICBM, cease developing any nuclear-capable missiles, and stop proliferating ballistic missiles to others.
They have clearly said unambiguously that the missile program was never part of the deal and can never be part of the deal. But I think that's just...
That's what I'm asking you. You know the mindset of the leadership, so... I think they can smile and say we don't plan to do this, but in reality, will they continue doing that? Is it realistic for Trump to expect them not to do that?
I think it would have been more realistic if Trump had Europe, China, and Russia on his side. Mm-hmm. That common voice and force, I think, could have convinced them to stop doing these missiles and certainly to stop being so provocative about them, because they not only tested, but they wrote in Hebrew on it that this was a Israel-destroying missile. Mm-hmm. So that kind of stupidity certainly could stop.
Yes.
But if enough pressure is brought, I think with Europeans and the rest, I think it might be.
Here is condition number two. Iran must, and I quote, cease support for terrorist, extremist, and regional proxies such as Hezbollah, Hamas, the Taliban, and Al-Qaeda. How likely?
Very unlikely. But it is very likely that they can be convinced that they need to mitigate that. They need to be less adventurous. They need to be less aggressive. They need to be less open about it. Mm-hmm. They have now become, a few years ago, they were completely discreet about the role they had in Lebanon and in Syria. Now they openly talk about it. They openly talk about the fact that they have forces there, they have bases there. I think they can be pushed back to a much more limited restraint. But they see those as their hedge against the possibility of an Israeli or a U.S. attack.
All right. Condition number three, Abbas. Iran must, quote, end its publicly declared quest to destroy Israel.
I think that for the moderate, quote unquote, that's not very difficult to do. Khamenei would be very hard to be convinced because, again, his anti-Israeli rhetoric that he has often repeated is very much part of his political persona. But he is, you know, and has been for a couple of years on his deathbed.
Right.
And when he passes, I think that is not, for me, inconceivable. And I have to say that rhetoric coming from a leader of Iran, where Jews have lived for 3,000 years, where Iran was, along with Turkey, the first Muslim countries to recognize the state of Israel, mm-hmm. is profoundly sad.
So you're suggesting that moderate Iranians could be similar to, say, the Saudis, who have moved in terms of their position toward Israel?
No, a moderate, rational Iranian regime mm-hmm. was far ahead of Saudis, long before Saudis thought about talking to Israel. Mm-hmm. Iran had very close relationship with Israel, intelligence, military, economic. That's when Saudi Arabia was sort of in the forefront of the anti-Israeli camp, Iran was selling oil to. That sentiment is an Iranian sentiment. It wasn't just the Shah sentiment.
Okay. Condition number four, Abbas. Iran must, quote, stop its threats to freedom of navigation, especially in the Persian Gulf and the Red Sea.
I think that's very doable. And I think, in a sense, that has already been accomplished. I think they know that General Mattis is now in charge.
Yes.
There's a new sheriff.
Yes.
They know Donald Trump is the president. And
They're probably not averse to taking out a speedboat if need be, right?
And they will not be averse to take the speedboat. And I think in the last few months, after mm-hmm. Trump and Mattis have taken over, the kind of shenanigans that those speedboats used to engage in, I think, has ceased.
Yes. Okay. Condition number five, Iran must, quote, cease escalating the Yemen conflict and stabilizing the region by proliferating weapons to the Houthis. And indeed, yesterday, missiles were fired out of Yemen toward the Saudi capital.
Again, I think if the Saudis, on that case, if the Saudis can be convinced to de-escalate, because the Saudis are the ones who are spending billions of dollars in fighting that war.
Right.
Iran is fighting it with millions, mm-hmm. It is playing a very, for them, profitable role in destabilizing and making trouble for Saudi Arabia. But I think that has to be part of a larger agreement. I think Trump administration has to bring more pressure on Saudi Arabia to de-escalate in Yemen. And if they do that, I think Iran can easily, this regime can easily forego that.
Condition number six, and you can relate to this one, Abbas, Iran must, quote, end its cyber attacks against the United States and our allies, including Israel. No more cyber attacks.
I think that can be very much part of an agreement. But again, you have to remember, this is not a, at least not hitherto, a unified regime. There are elements within the regime. There are the radical elements within the regime who believe that they shouldn't back down. And some of them have the ability to engage in this kind of stupid hacking game. And to put it in a little bit of a context, they have been subject to some very serious hacks. Probably the most serious hack attack in recent memory is Stuxnet, which was apparently joint Israeli-U.S. So if there is lower temperature all around, they will have much less incentive to be as provocative as they have been.
Okay, condition seven, Abbas, Iran must, quote, stop its unjust detention of foreigners, including American citizens.
I think that can be easily done. These people are pawns for the regime. If the regime thinks that they have become a liability, they have been in the past known to give up these liabilities. And if they think they can use them for concessions from the West, they'll do it. And unfortunately, in the past, the Europeans have repeatedly made concessions to the Iranian regime. The U.S. has on occasions made concessions to the Iranian regime for the release of these dual citizens. And they have learned the wrong lesson from this.
In the final condition, Abbas, Iran must, quote, stop its grievous human rights abuses shown most recently in the regime's crackdown against widespread protest by Iranian citizens.
Absolutely, I think. I always thought that should have been part of the initial agreement. That was one of my complaints about the initial agreement, that it didn't talk about human rights at all. And I think, again, you can't expect this regime, which is to its in its core a brutal, despotic regime, to become a democratic regime. But they have also shown in the past that if they think there is an international consensus that they've gone too far, they tend to back down.
Right. Okay, Abbas, the question is now, what next? Trump has made his action. The Iranians have replied with rather hot rhetoric. A show of missiles launched against the Saudis yesterday. Missiles launched against the Israelis, which prompted an Israeli counterattack on an airbase outside of Damascus. But what next in terms of trying to get back on this page of solving the Iran nuclear situation? Do we expect a gesture to come out of Washington? Do we expect a gesture to come out of Tehran? Or let me throw a third scenario at you. Somebody tries to intervene, say Emmanuel Macron, Angela Merkel, someone from Europe. What's your thought?
My guess is that the last option,
not
just one European country, you know, the three allies of the United States have issued a joint statement.
Right.
Saying that they're going to try their best to preserve the deal. And I think behind the door, they're also telling the U.S. that they're going to try to see if they can get what the U.S. wants.
Right.
I think the other unknown factor in all of this is how Russia is going to play it. I think Russia very much prefers an isolated Iran.
Right.
The more isolated Iran is, the more they will have to cozy up to Russia. And Khamenei, the supreme leader, has shown a historic tendency to want to repivot Iran towards Russia.
When we talk about Iran fomenting terrorism in terms of Hamas, in terms of Hezbollah, is any terrorist activity directed toward Russia or neighboring countries around Russia?
From supported by Iran?
Supported by Iran. Does Iran spend its dollars that way, or its dollars spent in the other direction, towards Syria,
no,
toward Israel?
No. I mean, in fact, the regime is embarrassingly silent when, for example, the Muslims are killed in Myanmar.
Right.
They're completely silent when Russia took out the Muslims in Chechnya.
Yes.
So the notion that they support Muslims or they support terrorists everywhere doesn't seem to fit with the reality. They're very opportunistic in who they support and whose brutal suppression they decide to remain silent on.
Are they fearful of Putin? Do they just not want to tangle with Vladimir Putin, or do they already have a full plate with other countries in the region?
I think they're both afraid of Putin, but mm-hmm. also they're beholden to Putin. They need Putin. They have needed Putin's support in the diplomatic realm. Mm-hmm. They need Putin's support in Syria. And more importantly, and for me more worrisome, is that Khamenei particularly, and some around him, think that a repivot away from not just the U.S., but Europe, towards Russia and towards China is in the long-term interest of the regime. And again, one of the things that is very clear is that, for example, the Iranian financial system is on the verge of collapse. Mm-hmm. Virtually all of the banks are de facto bankrupt.
Right.
They're all de facto Ponzi schemes. The only country that has enough cash sitting, waiting for this rotten apple to fall on its lap is China.
Right.
And if that pivot happens, then I think the long-term consequences are going to be with us long after Mr. Trump's tenure ends.
Can you quickly explain this disconnect in this regard, in that you're telling me on the one hand the country has a severe economic problem, on the other hand that country is pumping out a lot of oil? And oil is up at about $70, $80 a barrel right now. So you're telling me that the country, on the one hand, has a terrible cash situation. On the other hand, it has the ability to make a lot of cash by selling oil. So why this disconnect?
Well, because they don't have anything else other than the oil.
Like Venezuela.
I think there are a lot of similarities to Venezuela. Mm-hmm. And I think many people worry that Iran is the next Venezuela. they haven't been able to invest enough to tap into the oil reserves. Mm-hmm. They haven't certainly invested enough to tap into the gas reserves. Mm-hmm. So they have the ability to raise between 40 to 70 billion, but that hardly helps keep the lights on.
Right.
Because this is a rentier economists call it a rentier state. They sell the oil, they sell the gas, they take their percentage like a mafia boss and distribute the rest to the copper regime. Mm-hmm. And the people get very little of it. What is available is increasingly diminished because they don't have the investments. The Europeans aren't willing to make it. Mm-hmm. The Chinese have made some agreements, but that they haven't come forward to actually deliver on any of these projects. And if anybody was thinking about coming in with money, for example, to improve the oil and gas mm-hmm. sector, after yesterday, they're going to be very much more hesitant.
I don't know if you saw in the news this morning, Abbas, but the Israeli government issued a coin. And on that coin are two images. One is a profile of one Donald J. Trump, and the other is a profile of Cyrus the Great. Why would the Israeli government do that?
Well, because Netanyahu, in his last meeting with Donald Trump, said that Donald Trump is like Cyrus the Great. I think Netanyahu knows how much Mr. Trump loves to be praised.
Yes.
And it is hard to imagine a bigger praise than Cyrus, who is praised in the Old Testament the savior of the Jews.
Savior of the Jews, exactly. Yeah. All right. So you mentioned that the government in Tehran is, if not afraid of, intimidated by Vladimir Putin. Now that Trump has made this decision, what do you think they think of Donald Trump? Do they think that he is an enemy? Do they think that he is somebody now to be respected because he stood by his word? He's certainly not Barack Obama. We've learned that now. But do you think they can work with Donald Trump at all? Do you just try to take it from their perspective?
My sense is that the Khamenei, who gave a talk yesterday mm-hmm. on Donald Trump,
right.
talked very tough about him. He said, mm-hmm. called him this little man. Mm-hmm. And he said, bigger men than you have tried to bury our regime, and long after you're going to be eaten by worms, we're going to survive. But I think they are clearly afraid of Donald Trump. like many other people, there's that sort of, he is mad, let's not do something to anger him.
Right. If
this inability to anticipate what he might do, in a sense, by his behavior, he is creating something akin to what apparently Ronald Reagan wanted to create when
right.
he whispered something to somebody knowing that the mics were on, to give the Soviets the impression that he's mad enough that he might do something.
Right.
But Donald Trump, I think, clearly, by his behavior, has created that image. There's that unexpectedness about him.
Right. Now, there could be a political advisor in Tehran, Abbas, who studies American politics. And he or she could look at how Donald Trump got elected. He did not win the popular vote. He or she could determine by looking at American history that presidents who are elected not winning the popular vote generally don't fare too well come re-election. George H.W. Bush was re-elected, but otherwise presidents who lose the popular vote lose when they run for re-election. They could come to the conclusion that given that he didn't win the popular vote, given that it was actually a close election, several states swung it by very narrow margins, they could make the determination that Donald Trump is a one-term act, a one-trick pony, if you will. They could decide that, you know, we'll just ride this guy out until 2021 and roll the dice, and given the way that Americans are moving on presidential elections, we'll have a Democrat to deal with, and odds are there'll be a lot easier to work with this guy. So one school of thought, Abbas, is that the Iranians could just essentially ride out Trump until after the election, but this is May of 2018. That means there's half another year now, plus all of 2019, plus all of 20, that is 30-plus months.
Yeah.
And things will happen over the course of 30 months. So do you think we're in for 30 months of status quo, frozen now after this deal, or are we going to see movement on some part? And what I'm thinking in particular is maybe Emmanuel Macron steps into the void and starts to maybe try to bring the two sides together.
My sense is that, first of all, the economy is not going to wait 30 months.
Right.
I mean, I think they need to do something.
I mean, their economic conditions are only,
yeah,
they're not going to get better. If they're not going to get worse, they're going to remain bad.
Yeah.
Okay.
You can't have 70% of your currency lose
right.
its value and do nothing about it. Mm-hmm. You can't have, you know, the 60-odd percent of college women graduates are unemployed.
Mm-hmm.
40% of all college graduates are unemployed. These are remarkable numbers. Inflation.
So you're suggesting they will move in some way because what, they have to address the sanctions?
I think they have to address the economy.
Okay.
And they're going to try to, in my view, make some concessions to Europeans to see whether they can convince the Europeans to either convince the Americans not to impose secondary sanctions or convince the Europeans to stand up to the U.S. on the issue of the secondary sanctions. I think the latter one is more difficult because of just the sheer weight of the U.S. economy around the world.
Okay. So you think there will be some movement of some sort?
I think I can't imagine the status quo this way. I hope it doesn't move towards what has already happened in Syria, because there's been a rapid escalation of Iran-Israel confrontation in Israel, and I think a more major, more open war. The Iranians have been very reluctant to join the fray. They have been very circumspect in reporting it, because I think they know if they report it, they're going to have to come to battle, because they're going to lose their prestige. They're going to lose their image of someone who stands up to Israel. So my hope is that the way it moves is not towards a more destabilized and militarized region.
Okay, final question, Abbas. We've talked about what the Iranian move should be. What is Donald Trump's next move? I don't think having John Kerry engage in private shuttle diploma is an option, but what should the Americans be doing next?
Now that the decision has been made, I think in terms of the region, I think they should counsel Israel to be a little more cautious. I think everybody is trying to do that, and while confirming the fact that you can't allow the Iranians to shower you with missiles, but don't take it beyond the stage of serving notice that we are watching, we know what you're doing, and if you do it,
Don't escalate beyond.
Yeah, don't escalate it into a full war, and then discreetly with as little effort to interfere in Iranian politics, make the free flow of information available. Right now, I think the a major area of battle inside Iran is with the government's effort to control access of information and the people's effort to have access. That, to me, is the catalyst that will change the dire economic situation of today to a better political reality of tomorrow.
Final question, Abbas Milani. Donald Trump has indicated he will run for re-election. Let's assume he goes by his word, he does run for re-election. Come November of 2020, when he is seeking a second term, will the same government in Iran still be in power?
The same government or the same regime?
Well, same regime.
I think the same regime would be in power, but I think that most likely, the more likely scenario is that things will get so bad that the IRGC will seize power.
The Revolutionary Guard.
The Revolutionary Guards as a temporary, I think, effort to maintain an unmaintainable status quo.
Okay, but that sounds ominous because maintaining sounds like going after people's civil liberties.
Oh, absolutely.
Right.
I think that's almost for sure the instinct of the IRGC and the instinct of Khamenei. And they're not going to stand by and see the unraveling. So I think in the short term, unless there is truly enough pressure from below where they will see that a major restructuring, marginalizing of Khamenei, for example, marginalizing of his policies at least.
Right.
Unless they do that, I can't conceive of them having any alternative but a brutal.
Okay, but we saw with the Green Revolution, Abbas, when a little bit of protest broke out, it started spreading and the government had to move quick to break it down. Do you think the government could stop it if it happened a second time?
You know, they're very good at brutality, and they have done a lot of exercises, clearly. I've talked to a lot of people inside Iran, and they tell me that, you know, first of all, they have a lot of thugs, police, half police, secret police. I mean, it's all kinds of gradations of brute force that they bring to the streets. But they almost lost it this time.
Right.
And I think for the first day or two, they literally were paralyzed by how quickly it spread, and they how quickly it spread amongst the population they never thought would be their enemy, the poor, pious people of small cities. That was their base.
Right.
And they knew this is not a group that can be easily intimidated.
Okay, and indeed, the final question, I promise. This is a challenge facing the United States anytime there's unrest in another country. And we saw this in Syria, we saw this in Libya. If there is unrest, if there is a revolt, a revolution, an uprising by the people, what does the United States government do? Does the United States government get personally involved? Does it just symbolically say, we feel your pain, we've got your back? What would the United States of America do if, indeed, and this is a lot of hypotheticals, but under your scenario where the regime gets replaced by the Revolutionary Guard, the Revolutionary Guard starts cracking down, people start pushing back, and you now have an uprising in the streets. People are getting killed, it's violent, but perhaps Iran's at a tipping point. What does the American government do? Do we just stand by idly and watch it? Do we make a pronouncement which is symbolic, or do we in some way try to get involved? I'm not suggesting military action, but in some way try to tip the scale to make the change happen.
I think the worst option would be to try to get directly involved.
Really?
Because
it would just tie into previous propaganda.
Propaganda. Right. And, you know, Iranian people, like people everywhere, are proud people. They want to be the masters of their own fortune and fate. And I think they have proven that they have the prudence and they have now almost the infrastructure to bring about that change. I think in that case, if a military coup happens, I think the United States should try to bring the Europeans along and bring an enormous amount of economic pressure on the regime and say, we're not going to allow you to leave the country. We're going to freeze the assets of everyone who's part of this regime. We're not, you know, and let the Iranian people know that The world is watching, and brute military force is not going to be the answer for this complicated reality.
Okay. Dr. Abbas Milani, thank you for your time and a most timely conversation.
It's always a pleasure talking with you.
Thank you. You've been listening to Area 45, a Hoover Institution podcast on the policy avenues available to the 45th President of the United States. In this instance, we're talking about Iran. If you've been enjoying Area 45, please don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to us on iTunes. And if you wouldn't mind, please spread the word. Get your friends to download and have a listen. The Hoover Institution is online at www.hoover.org. And while you're there, sign up for the Hoover Daily Report, which delivers the best work of Abbas Milani and his Hoover colleagues to your inbox weekdays. The Hoover Institution has Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter feeds. Our Twitter handle is @HooverInst. That is @HooverInst. Dr. Abbas Milani is on Twitter, and his Twitter handle is @MilaniAbbas. And I will spell that out for you. MilaniAbbas, @MilaniAbbas. You'll find an entire page on the Stanford website dedicated to his research and writing. For the Hoover Institution, this is Bill Whalen. We'll be back soon with another installment of Area 45. Until then, take care. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution. For more podcasts from the Hoover Institution, please visit hoover.org or Hoover's channels on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Stitcher. I'm Chris Dower for the Hoover Institution. Thanks for listening.